Even though it's his hometown, writing a piece about New York proved problematic for American composer Derek Bermell until he started reading the letters of Hungarian composer Béla Bartók, who lived in New York in the last few years of his life.
I've always thought of Bartók as a Hungarian composer, and he certainly saw himself that way. But I was reading about how he spent the last 5 years of his life, 5 or 6 years of his life in New York. And many of the great European composers, Stravinsky, Schoenberg, they came over after World War II or before, and they spent the last years of their life, in a way, in exile from their home country in the U.S. You know, in that way, they were almost as much American composers late in life as they were European composers. And Bartók wrote all these wonderful letters home. I say wonderful, but they're actually kind of depressing for the most part. Because he was trying to figure out a new culture. And it was interesting to see New York through the eyes of somebody who, you know, for whom it was completely alien, because to me, New York is home. And so it gave me a kind of interesting perspective on my own city, that of an outsider trying to make sense of this chaotic place. So, you know, I guess that with that long introduction, that's to say that, you know, the piece is kind of my view. It was my way into writing a New York piece because everything else seemed so close, and this was a way to get some distance on the subject. And I think as an artist, it usually helps to be a little bit distant, to find some distance from the subject so that you can write about it. I think it's true with journalists and it's true with writers. You have to kind of maintain yourself at maybe not at 500 feet, but at least at 20 feet distance. So,
yes, to find those unique parameters at which to look at something. I love the way you focused on finding that the path before you started writing the piece. That sounds like something I think Stravinsky said once. He'd much rather a commission for, you know, a washed-up bass and piano with trumpet obbligato than a wide-open commission.
Yeah, limitations help to focus your mind. On the other hand, you know, that said, limitations can also be problematic, because if you hem yourself into a corner, then you don't leave room for creativity. So for me, you know, I think it's good to give yourself limitations that have some kind of openness to them, that they give you away. I mean, Stravinsky was famous for writing these pieces for the five fingers that were, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, that's a big limitation to write for these five notes. And he was very, very creative and could do something extraordinary with almost any material, like Beethoven. But he usually tried to pick good material, which I think was true for Beethoven, or something that he found especially inspiring. And I guess I found these letters quite heartrending because, you know, of course, he would never see his home again because he was already sick when he came to the U.S. He didn't know it, but he had leukemia. And some of his best moments were the moments where he was looking back at his country. For example, he spent several years transcribing a collection of Serbo-Croatian women's songs at the library of Columbia University, and that was kind of his job. He didn't have much money. He and his wife they kind of bounced around. They were in Queens, then they were all the way at the Upper Manhattan, and then they were near Midtown, and, you know. But, you know, there are some funny letters where he talks about kind of getting lost on the subway, and there were a lot of mixed feelings. I mean, he was hopeful at the same time for his own future and that of his kids, who one of whom came over, at least Peter Bartók, who I think is still alive and lives in Florida. But he wrote letters. There are a number of letters to Kodály, his colleague. There are letters to Szigeti, for whom he wrote Contrasts, the piece with Benny Goodman. And then there were a number of American students that he had, piano students, to whom he wrote letters, you know, sometimes also asking them about possible professional opportunities to come do things. But Bartók fundamentally didn't believe in teaching composition. He wanted to teach piano at Columbia, but they turned him down because there was already a piano teacher there. Can you imagine? They turned down Bartók to teach piano. So,
well, I would be a little frustrated with a composer saying, I don't want to teach composition from the Yale point of view.
He felt it couldn't be taught. I mean, he was open to teaching, but he wanted to teach about the folk music of Hungary, which there was, they, you know, they had no real space for that, or he wanted to teach piano, you know, because he felt that you could kind of, that composition was one of those things you kind of teach around, which I believe too. I think theory and history analysis, you can teach your training, things like that, but it's very hard to actually teach composition. When you teach composition, you kind of end up mostly teaching those, all those things. Teaching anything very creative, it's kind of an amorphous thing. So I can understand why he felt that way, that he didn't know what to teach composition. But because for him, I think teaching was something very rigorous, and Bartok was an extremely rigorous, rigorous thinker. You know, he was very mathematical in his thinking. He liked very clear structures, and he liked a consistent and clear harmonic language. Not only harmonic, but harmonic, rhythmic, formal language. I mean, he used the golden mean in constructing the form of his pieces. He was very, very careful. He analyzed his own string quartets. That you could actually see the analyses that he would publish with the quartet. So he was a, you know, very fastidious kind of person, and I can see him thinking that teaching composition might be a little too loosey-goosey, you know?
Yeah. So in addressing this piece, you must have thought, well, there's a whole world of Bartok's Hungarian themes he cared about, and plus the idea of New York, your hometown. How did that start to coalesce as a piece?
Well, by the way, I would recommend that anybody read those letters. They're really wonderful letters. They're quite humble in a lot of ways, as he was obviously a very humble person, and a lot of them have to do with very mundane things, but they're published by St. Martin's Press. The translations are published by St. Martin's Press. And I guess what I felt was I just wanted to address three different aspects that the letters showed. I mean, the first one kind of hopeful, full of life, and I guess, you know, in some sense that refers to the period of time that he spent really dwelling on what was his great passion, which was the folk song of his native country and regions nearby. And so he spent a lot of time, as I said, at Columbia Library transcribing these songs. So I used that as a kind of jumping off point for the first movement, which I called Americanizalodik, which I, as far as I can understand, means kind of Americanization. So it's kind of I suppose it has a kind of the feel of these Hungarian rhythms. A lot of them are in odd meters that I use in this movement, but then they're kind of mixed with kind of more jazzy sonorities. And I can imagine that, you know, his kind of mixing as he came to the States and he heard so many sounds from jazz and kind of popular music, and no doubt many American composers too, like Copland and Gershwin and composers like that, that he probably had not heard so much of until he came to the States. And then the second movement, I wanted to kind of get across the more melancholy side of Bartok. And he wrote a lot of night music pieces, and that's what this is actually called, night music, but I used Hungarian titles. Bartok was kind of the originator of this idea of night music. I mean, actually, there are composers who wrote night music before Bartok, but he would write these strange middle movements, which were quite meditative and had sounds of nature in them, and a lot of kind of creaking types of sounds, very small, little repetitive sounds, you know, sounds of maybe of insects or birds, bird songs, and this kind of very mesmerizing, slow kind of undercurrent that runs through it. So you hear this in a lot of Bartok pieces, like Outdoor Suite and many, many, many of his string quartets and other pieces. But so that's the second movement. Then the third movement is, you know, more of a meditation on this idea of these ghosts walking around the city. I guess I thought a lot about how there are these, so many immigrants like Bartok arrived in New York with all the kind of hope and fear that you have when you leave your country and you leave everything that you've known and loved your whole life, and you come to, or known and hated, both, and you come to a new place that's just full of strange people and strange customs, and you just have to kind of adapt. And so I thought about all those those traces that are left of these people, and New York is really made up of that. It's a city of immigrants, a city of exiles. And even though someone like me, I mean, I'm from New York, and I think of it as my own, but actually it has all these traces of these folks who walked the streets and from other places who left their mark on the city. And I thought, wow, you know, New York is as much a place of foreigners as it is. It doesn't belong to those who are from there. It belongs to everybody. It's really a city of hopes and dreams, many of which were dashed, but it's a composite, you know, and it doesn't belong to those who were born there necessarily. It belongs to people from the ages. And so that was an interesting reflection on my own hometown. And I think that kind of perspective of starting with these letters of exile gave me an interesting way in which to look back at the place where I'm from.
Well, I think you just did a great job of answering the, in long form, why you called it a shout, a whisper, and a trace. That stands for each of the three movements in the work.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I mean, it was meant to be kind of metaphorical also, but you could also say that each movement represents, on some level, what you hear, 1, 2, 3, like that. The last movement, this vague, which I just wrote, that is the last word that Bartok wrote on the viola concerto, which means end. I think appropriately, because he was a humble person and, you know, he didn't go out with a bang, as it were.
That's the thing. Do you think he would have, if he'd had more time, he would have embraced New York eventually and come to see the wonderful things about it and become an American Hungarian?
He probably had already a little bit, in the sense that he'd probably resigned himself to the place. But, you know, he was quite happy when he was out of the city, actually, because I think he was overwhelmed by New York, and especially because he was sick. And also his character, you know, he was from a small country, and I think it was overwhelming being in New York. His last years, he spent a lot of time, I think it was down in North Carolina, where he was working on, I can't remember who was, that there was somebody, it might have even been Menuhin, who had commissioned this concerto from him, and he had, maybe Menuhin set up a place for him to go, but he spent some time in Vermont, he was a couple times in Seattle. He was generally happier when he was outside of New York and when he was in nature. And I think it was probably mostly due to his health. I don't know, Bartok, you know, I think he derived a lot of his essence from being kind of, I wouldn't say down, but a little bit dour. It was part of who he was, and I think it enabled him to keep going. I mean, he always kind of felt a little oppressed. You can read it in his letters, which you can understand being from where he was from, and, you know, life wasn't easy. And I think that was part of his, he was just part of who he was and his nature. And I'm not sure he ever would have been rah-rah about America. I think the whole kind of American optimism was something that he did not relate to at all. On the other hand, America gave him, I mean, he also realized what he was getting when he came to America. But he was, you know, he realized that he was getting the opportunity to start again, and that he was avoiding something, you know, an encroaching fate that was not very hopeful in Hungary, and the authorities were starting to kind of come down on him, and he realized it was time for him to get out before the Nazis came down on him. And so they escaped. They went to Portugal. They lost a lot of their stuff, as a lot of people did on the way, you know, just on the passage. But and I think Bartok, in his way, in his kind of grumpy way, was quite loyal to Colombia, which kept extending his tenure there, working on these Yugoslavian folk songs. It's not like they really needed somebody to work on these folk songs, but, you know, I think they felt, you know, that he was happy, and they wanted to make him happy in whatever way they could. And so they gave him a kind of base salary, which I think really, really helped him. But Bartok was a very proud person. He wouldn't take money without a reason. When Koussevitzky came to him with a check for $1,000, he said, which was a lot of money back then, you know, in the early 40s, he said, no, I will not take charity. So, but if you want me to write a piece, I'll write a piece. And he wrote the Concerto for Orchestra, which is one of his great works. But he wouldn't take charity. So he insisted to be paid for. And in a way, that's very American, I think. You know, he wanted to work for his money and, you know, get paid for some sort of work, you know, which is, I think, quite American.
Well, I am glad you brought up Serge Koussevitzky again, because I think he embraced America early and often. And I just think there's a wonderful grand symmetry here, that from a man who helped out Bartok in his day, comes this Serge Koussevitzky Foundation, which also gives a grant to a promising young American composer to write a piece that happens to be related to Bartok's last years in America.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I never thought of that, but I don't think of myself in the same sentence as Koussevitzky, but it's, yeah, it, I mean, it is true that he did do a lot for composers. I mean, one of the things I really remember, well, in addition to Copland, many, many other people, Bernstein, but Koussevitzky, you know, his house at Tanglewood is where we stayed when we were fellows, when I was a fellow in 1995 in the summer, and we stayed at Koussevitzky's house. We stayed in the servants' quarters, but years later, when I went back, you know, they hosted me in his house, actually in his room, which was quite, you know, that was quite grand. But at the time, it was really amazing to be in Koussevitzky's house. You know, you'd go, you know, kind of sneak over into the main part of the house, and you'd see the picture of him with his bass there, and there were a lot of events happening in that house, but it was a piece of history and is a piece of history up at Tanglewood Saranac, which was Koussevitzky's house. And he's certainly somebody who came over and helped many, many composers, really got people their first big commissions, too many to mention, really.
So with Raymond Harvey conducting your piece, did he consult with you at all, or is it more his job to work up his own interpretation and then maybe consult with you later?
Well, that's often the way. I mean, I think a conductor, I mean, no, he hasn't called me or anything, but I think a conductor often wants to deal with the score on their own, you know, what you wrote before. And, you know, and he can, of course, read what I wrote about the piece. So I wrote a program note that's in the score. And I think, you know, he probably chose carefully what he was going to do on that program, and he saw a way that this piece fit in. And he's probably studying the score and just, you know, getting to know it. And maybe if he has questions, he'll contact me. Quite often people play the piece and I never hear from the conductor. Sometimes the conductor is calling me all the time with questions, you know. And either way is fine, because when you write down a piece, when you write down every note, you know, you figure, well, I've written down these hundreds of thousands of notes or millions of notes in some case, millions of markings, I don't know. And you feel like, okay, well, there it is. You know, I've done my best to get that across. But at the same time, it's fine if the conductor wants to touch base and has certain questions, either technical or more philosophical. Sometimes the type of questions that conductors ask most tend to be about tempo. I know Raymond Harvey, you know, a bit because I played my clarinet concerto with the Kalamazoo Symphony a number of years ago. It must have been about 10 years ago or maybe less. I don't know. But I had a great time in Kalamazoo. Also spent time there for the Fontana Chamber Arts. They commissioned a piece for me when Ann Bergquist was there. And also at Western Michigan University, I've been there. So it's a real town with a wonderful, lively tradition of music making and I'm sure Maestro Harvey is going to do a great job with the piece. I mean, I remember having a wonderful experience there last time playing my concerto. And I don't think he called me before that to discuss either. I think he just had it. He had, you know, he had the music in his head, and you know, that's what you hope for as a composer, that that people really engage with it on that serious level, which he does, I know.
Well, it sounds like you won't be able to join us on March 22nd for this performance.
Actually, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, not sure what. I know I'm doing something with the Philadelphia Orchestra around then.
What a problem to have.
I think it's great when an orchestra like the Kalamazoo Symphony decides to really engage with a new piece and put it on their season. And I really applaud Maestro Harvey for doing that, because I think it's really essential. That's how the music really gets out there. I mean, it's one thing to have your work played in, you know, New York and Chicago and L.A., that kind of thing. But when when it's played in Kalamazoo, that's, I don't want to get too Sarah Palin on you, but that's real America kind of hearing your music. That's smaller towns and smaller places engaging with new music, with what composers have to say or artists have to say. And that, I think it's very important that new music is embraced by all places. And this year, I feel like I've been very lucky. This piece was played in Richmond, Virginia, and it was played in Tacoma, Washington, and it's being played out in California, but somewhere in the hinterlands at the Idlewild Arts Academy. And, you know, so that's kind of closer to Palm Springs and Kalamazoo, you know. So I feel like it's great when a piece gets to all these places, as opposed to just, you know, the capital cities or something.
I spoke with American composer Derek Bermel, whose work, A Shout, A Whisper, and A Trace, will be performed by the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra on March 22nd, conducted by Raymond Harvey. I'm Kara LaRance.